ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening. Welcome to PM. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, more questions raised about the US president's security after shots were fired outside a function he was attending. Also, police continue to search for a five-year-old girl they suspect was abducted from a home in Alice Springs. And Kenyans living in Australia express their pride at Sebastian Sawe's marathon world record.
It's a proud moment in what Sebastian and the rest have achieved over the years. It speaks discipline, our resilience, and the spirit that defines our Kenyan people.
Investigators in the United States are looking into the motives of the man who was detained after attempting to breach security at a function attended by Donald Trump and senior members of his administration. Little is known about 31-year-old Cole Thomas Allen, but authorities believe he could have been targeting the president. He's being linked to a roughly 1,000-word manifesto in which he describes himself as a friendly federal assassin. The event has again raised concerns about the level of security around the US president. Barbara Miller reports.
There's just been a major security incident here.
The ABC's America's editor John Lyons, in the moments after the US president, his wife and senior members of the administration have been whisked out of the ballroom of the Washington Hilton Hotel after a heavily armed man tried to breach security. On stage, the entertainment for the night was Oz Perlman, a mind reader who watched Donald Trump being forcibly removed from his seat.
I knew it was serious when they didn't just walk him out of the room, when they jumped on top of him. That's when my panic went off inside. And I said, this is real.
In the chaotic minutes that followed, other important guests were marched from the room as John Lyons looked on.
They seem to have got someone here. They've taken someone away. They're rescuing. That guy's a VIP. He had three or four Secret Service people.
On the floor in front of John and visible in his recording is a man lying on top of a woman to shield her. It's now clear that woman was Kerry Kennedy, the sister of the Health Secretary, RFK Jr. The man, Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin. Kerry Kennedy spoke to MSN Now.
Jamie just used his whole body to shield me, like the hero that he is. And he kept whispering, "You're okay, you're okay, you're okay." I was so scared. It was like my body could not move. I had no control of my body.
Kerry Kennedy's uncle, John F. Kennedy, and her father, Robert F. Kennedy, were both assassinated.
I just was thinking so much about my dad, who, of course, was killed by a shooter in a situation like that.
It's a marker of the extent of political violence in the United States that Kerry Kennedy and her brother were not alone among the guests as having direct experience of it. Erica Kirk, widow of political activist Charlie Kirk, who was assassinated last year, was escorted out in tears.
I just want to go find.
The incident happened at the same hotel where there was an attempt on the life of President Ronald Reagan, and this could now be the third possible assassination attempt Donald Trump has faced. The president says risk comes with the job.
I can't imagine that there's any profession that's more dangerous. But I love the country and I'm very proud. I'm very proud of the job we've done.
But just like the incidents at the rally in Butler, Pennsylvania in 2024, where a bullet grazed the then presidential candidate's ear, and later that year on his golf course in Florida, where an armed man was found waiting in bushes, questions are again being asked about how it was possible for someone to get this close to Donald Trump. Former Secret Service Special Agent Mike Matranga said the president was never in imminent danger.
Did you see how fast he was running? You know, the officers and the agents have literally split seconds to determine if this guy is a threat or not. And so I think that the plan worked.
Jonathan Gillam, a former Navy SEAL and FBI agent, disagrees.
If you try to go to a Super Bowl or a big important soccer match, you're not going to be able to get in within a perimeter with, for instance, in the Super Bowl with a bag that's not clear. And even those bags are very small. So why do they put that protection on the Super Bowl, but they won't do it for the leader of the free world and 3,000 people that are in the room with him? His entire cabinet pretty much was there. It's very aggravating.
According to the text of an alleged manifesto, the gunman was targeting administration officials. In the alleged manifesto, referenced by the president and published by the New York Post, the suspect, who refers to himself as a friendly federal assassin, also expresses surprise that he was able to get weapons into the hotel so easily. The part-time teacher will face court later.
Barbara Miller reporting. Corey Alpert worked in the White House during the previous administration of Joe Biden and has been involved with three presidential campaigns for the Democratic Party. He's living in Australia, where he's completing a doctorate at the University of Melbourne. He says Donald Trump has fueled the flames of political violence in the United States to his own detriment. I spoke to him earlier. Corey Alpert, the man in custody over the shooting is being tied to a manifesto in which he expresses anger at the Trump administration. How do you assess the level of anger in the political discourse in the United States right now?
Right now is one of those incredibly tense moments that we see every generation or so in the United States. We've seen this really intense rise that has been really further inflamed by what Donald Trump and the Trump administration are doing in that political discourse.
Any event like this, the president wants to use it to his own advantage. Do you think that this can be used to Donald Trump's advantage?
I think Donald Trump was expecting to be able to turn this into the kind of political juggernaut that he was able to have in the aftermath of the attempted assassination in Butler, Pennsylvania, where that really became one of the media narratives that took him through potentially to even winning that election. And I think it says a lot that in the immediate aftermath of this event yesterday, the reaction even from Trump's own voters that I'm seeing on social media and in media reports around the country is definitely not sort of a galvanizing around the president and almost going into the territory of questioning if this was staged, questioning the timing of it, and questioning Trump's reaction to it. I think we're seeing a lot in that response that some of Trump's magic, what he's been able to do to convince his own voters and to convince the American public broadly, that magic does seem to be fading. And I think we're seeing that in the response to what happened yesterday.
Do you think ordinary Americans watch events like yesterday with shock and horror, or are they becoming more immune to these sorts of scenes in Trump's America?
I think we're becoming pretty immune to it. You know, first of all, Americans are quite immune now to gun violence, you know, especially in the last 30 or so years of school shootings. Even a news story about an attack on children now only lasts a couple of hours. And political scandals in the United States right now just don't stick around in the media all that long. There's too much happening, and we've become immune to a lot of the violence that surrounds it. And that is not a good thing.
So you say that he's basically fueling the fires of political violence?
I think so. And really that represents a massive mistake. Fire doesn't stop. Fire doesn't only move in one direction. Fire consumes everything around it. And by creating a political environment that's more tense, in which violence becomes more likely in every direction, Donald Trump is creating and is fomenting a situation in which more of this violence becomes likely and possible. Again, we only need to look back to attacks just last year where leading figures on both sides were facing deadly attacks. That is not normal. That should never be condoned. And any rhetoric and anything that's happening in the political space that makes that more likely should be tamped down.
How is the Iran war influencing the political climate in the U.S. right now?
Well, I think in general, you know, you have a lot of Trump's voters and his base that are losing faith that the Trump administration is doing what they said that they were going to do. A lot of his voters are anti-war. They're people who voted for him on the promise that Trump would end forever wars and that he would end sort of U.S. military involvement in that part of the world. And then to see and hear Donald Trump go and launch this war that doesn't really seem to have an end point, you have a lot of his voters that are nervous and they're frustrated. I don't think that's necessarily playing into the violence of the moment, but it's certainly playing into the precarity of the political situation right now, where Donald Trump's approval rating is at its lowest point since January 6th. And you have an entire American political system that is losing its faith in Donald Trump, even as he tries to sort of go through all of his greatest hits and what he's normally able to do in controlling the media cycle. That magic that he's had for a decade seems to be fading, and he seems to not be able to convince even his own base to go along with the ruse anymore.
Corey Alpert, thanks for joining PM.
Thanks for having me.
That's former White House advisor Corey Alpert. This is PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. The Northern Territory Police suspect a missing 5-year-old girl was abducted from her home in Alice Springs on Sunday morning. They're searching for a man who was recently released from prison who was staying at her family's home. Jane Barden reports.
Police and Alice Springs Aboriginal community members have been searching bushland on the Dry Todd riverbed for 5-year-old Sharon Granitz since early on Sunday morning.
Search teams have consisted of the drone unit, horses, dog operations, TRG, ATVs, motorcycles, ground units and NTES volunteers. That search continues.
Acting Police Commander Mark Grieve says the 5-year-old was put to bed at her mother's house at the Old Timers Town Camp in Alice Springs at 11:30pm on Saturday night, and her mother discovered that she was missing at 1:30am.
She was last seen wearing a dark blue short sleeve t-shirt and a pair of black boxer style underwear.
He says police believe the young girl may have been abducted by 47-year-old Jefferson Lewis, who was recently released from prison. He had been staying at Sharon's house and was there on Saturday afternoon and evening.
Considering himself and Sharon went missing at around about the same time, it certainly brings about those suspicious circumstances, and we'd like to speak to him about that.
The NT Court Service says Mr. Lewis has a long violent criminal history, which doesn't include any child offences. Acting Police Commander Mark Grieve.
A lot of them were physical assaults. I believe there was some domestic violence history.
Police say Mr. Lewis isn't related to Sharon Granitz. Her family are well-known Walpuri leaders from a remote community near Alice Springs, and they include some renowned artists. The family told the ABC through friends they didn't want to be interviewed yet. Acting Commander Grieve says it's a nightmare situation for them.
You know, we're over 24 hours now, so it'd certainly be my worst nightmare as a parent.
Alice Springs Town Camps are Aboriginal suburbs spread throughout the town. Members of the Tangentyere Aboriginal Council, which provides support services and programs to Town Camp residents, have helped with the search. The council's president is Maxine Carlton.
We jumped on board as soon as we heard, and we are all distraught. We hope that there will be a light at the end of the tunnel, that, you know, we find our granddaughter. We are providing ongoing support to families assisting in Old Timers Camp, and we will be providing ongoing support to the family assisting them.
Local independent MP Robin Lamley says Sharon Granitz's disappearance has rocked all of Alice Springs.
This news is deeply disturbing, and I think it's really crushed our community of Alice Springs hearing that this little girl's gone missing and perhaps even abducted. In Alice Springs, we have about 19 or 20 town camps, and these are quite run down and disadvantaged. So the families that come from town camps quite generally are doing it tough. And we are a very small town, Alice Springs. We've only got 25,000 people. And for a little girl, one of our own, to go missing, so tragically. Hopefully she will be found, but if she's not, it is devastating news. It really makes you feel quite sick and very, very sad for the family.
NT Education Minister Jo Hersey says authorities are doing everything they can to find her.
My heart goes out to that family. It's absolutely tragic, you know, circumstances. I know that the police are doing all they can in that search. They're asking for people with any CCTV footage around the area, and I certainly hope that they come up with little Sharon for those parents very soon.
NT Education Minister Jo Hersey ending Jane Barden's report. The Tasmanian government is making it easier for social media influencers to spruik the wonders of Tasmania's natural environment to their followers. It's introduced what's called an enthusiast business license to allow content creators to enter the state's national parks at a lower cost. Social media experts say it's a clever idea for state governments who could save some money on expensive tourist marketing campaigns. Scott Wallen reports.
Australia is home to some of the oldest and most picturesque national parks in the world. And while they feature in almost every costly tourism advertisement put together by a team of marketing professionals, the Tasmanian government is now making it easier for influencers to post content from their national parks on social media. Nick Digan is Tasmania's Minister for Parks.
I don't want to see people overburdened with red tape and regulation, so we've made changes to those small content creators so they can go into our national parks and make a video at a relatively low cost and an easy access.
Under new regulations, influencers and content creators will now be able to film and profit from content gathered in Tasmania's national parks for just $100. Previously, the system was more complicated.
I needed to get public liability insurance for $20 million, pay a fee of around $450, apply 28 days in advance, and for me, that wasn't worth the amount of money that would have cost would have been more than what I would have made.
Mike Atkinson is a social media influencer under the name Outback Mike.
G'day, it's Mike and I'm climbing the 10 highest peaks in Australia. I'm with my two kids on a 7-day unsupported trek along the spine of the Snowy Mountains.
He says he welcomes the new license.
This is definitely an improvement, the enthusiast pass that they've brought in. They've removed the requirement for public liability insurance. The fee's only $100. It goes for 2 years.
The license is for solo content creators who engage in small-scale filming and photography using handheld devices. The use of drones is not permitted. It also comes with other rules.
I think it's a little overly restrictive to say that you cannot leave a track. There are plenty of places where in remote wilderness areas it's fine to leave a track. The general public can leave the track all over the place, and I don't think we should be confined to the track.
A Tasmania Parks and Wildlife Service spokesperson says the new license was part of a goal to minimise environmental impact. There's also questions about how it will be policed.
I don't think the government should spend their time combing social media. If the public see that someone is breaking a rule, they should tell National Parks, and then National Parks, that's just the way the law works. If people break a rule, then they get punished. But if they don't, and particularly if they're promoting messaging that National Parks really needs to get out there themselves, then it's a win-win.
Anne Hardy is an adjunct professor of tourism at Southern Cross University. She says the new license is a great tool to combat over-tourism and damage to the environment.
I really would like to know is how will they actually monitor where the influencers and filmmakers are going, and will they be able to stop content being made in sites that are subjected to over-tourism? If we could get clarity that it's going to be used to try and protect and prevent over-tourism in the really highly popular areas, then this could actually be quite a powerful mechanism.
Belinda Barnett is a senior lecturer in media at Swinburne University of Technology. She says it's a concept that should be adopted Australia-wide.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea. It will potentially make some money for the parks and wildlife in Tasmania. And most people do it anyway without a licence. The vast majority.
Ms. Barnett says it shows the growing power influencers have when it comes to marketing.
They've become a demographic, obviously, that governments are paying attention to and organisations are paying attention to. There's an argument that you'd want them to behave better, but I think the licence seems to reflect that.
Belinda Barnett from Swinburne University of Technology, ending that report by Scout Wallen and Kathleen O'Connor. It's a race usually defined by steps, but Kenyan athlete Sebastian Sawe has taken one giant leap for the marathon. He's made history at the London Marathon by becoming the first athlete to run a competitive race under 2 hours. Observers say that in doing so, he's smashed through one of sport's last great barriers. David Sparks reports.
Well, this performance is going to reverberate around the world one way or another.
As Kenyan Sebastian Sawe and Ethiopian Yomif Kejelcha pushed each other at breakneck speed, it slowly became apparent they might achieve something extraordinary.
This late in the race, they are projected to run under 2 hours.
Defying pain and history, a record was smashed at the London Marathon.
Sebastian Sawe is going to break the 2 hour mark. He's going to win the London Marathon.
Sawe crossing the line in 1 hour, 59 minutes and 30 seconds.
Absolutely incredible. I've never seen anything like that. What a finish.
And when Kejelcha crossed the line in second place, he was also just under the 2 hour mark. Despite his stunning victory, 31-year-old Sebastian Sawe was humble afterwards.
I'm feeling good. I'm so happy. It's a day to remember for me.
In 2019, another Kenyan, Eliud Kipchoge, did run a marathon under 2 hours, but that didn't count because he did it with the help of rotating runners acting as pacemakers, and it was not an official race. In any case, this new legitimate run by Sawe beat that illegitimate time by 10 seconds. Steve Monteghetti is one of Australia's greatest marathon runners. He's amazed by this achievement.
Oh, gee, incredible just that they would run so fast. And, you know, I think we all realised the barrier was becoming approachable, but when it actually happens, and I think the surprising thing probably on the London Marathon course, which, you know, it's fast and always got a quality feel, but hasn't held the world record for a while, if ever. So that was probably the surprise that it happened. And two people, or three people going under the old world record in two under 2 hours has just shocked us all, I think.
What is it about the Kenyans? Why are we always looking at the Kenyans doing this sort of thing?
Well, Kenyans and Ethiopians, so the African domination, you know, and they're obviously born at altitude, so they get that sort of oxygen benefit, and they just grow up with it. It's in their culture now that, you know, they have so many young people. I remember going to Kenya and going for a run and doing my long run and just having young kids running beside me in their Sunday best. It was a Sunday morning. They were going to church and they were filling in time by just running an hour beside me. You know, and I was at the peak of my powers. And so it's inbred in them. They grow up with it. And now it's, you know, they're having such success that it became, you know, success breeds success.
I want to ask you about the nature of extreme physical achievement. They must be just in extreme pain for a huge last section of that race.
Well, you are pushing the boundaries of yourself. You don't, it's interesting because you don't sort of think about, you know, doing something that, you know, that the human body's not meant to do. It's kind of an individual thing. So it's kind of this battle of externally, wow, you look like a freak, a machine. Wow, you could do this robotic, you could do this all day. But on the inside, you know, the physical pain's really building. And so you can imagine the mental trauma that that puts on your body just to push through that.
Kenyans all over the world are rejoicing in Sebastian Sawe's achievement. David Kamande is president of the Kenyan Community Victoria.
It's a proud moment, not just for Kenya, but for even the diaspora community, especially the one here in Australia. And what Sebastian and the rest have achieved over the years, it goes beyond sport. It speaks discipline, our resilience, and the spirit that defines our Kenyan people. It's very, very incredibly inspiring.
Do a lot of people actually run in Kenya?
Running is a lifestyle in Kenya. From a young age, it helped us to embrace identity and heritage. We start from a humble beginning. Most of these famous runners you've seen, they've started barefoot.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
Up in the mountains.
I wanted to ask you if that's a bit of a cliche we have in the Western world or if that actually still is a reality that people run in bare feet.
It's a reality. Mm. It's definitely a reality that people are still doing that. It helps you to be disciplined. It helps you also to appreciate the little things in life.
As for whether Sebastian Sawe's achievement will pave the way for a flood of other runners to suddenly break the two-hour mark, Steve Monageti isn't so sure.
I think we've seen something pretty exceptional. So there will be people who will sneak under 2 hours, but I don't think we should really appreciate this moment, because it's a mark in history that we will remember for our lives, and that isn't going to be achieved by that many people. Well, not in my lifetime, so appreciate it while we can.
Former marathon runner Steve Monageti, David Sparks reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Rachel Mealy. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump had taken his seat at the White House Correspondents' Dinner not long before a 31-year-old tried to burst in, armed with guns and knives. Today we speak to Missy Ryan, staff writer at The Atlantic, who was in the room, about the security failings and Trump's response. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.